You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, well, you've come to the right place. That's what we do here. We take your calls and we answer your questions about all of those things and more. In fact, if you've got a question about anything to the table, I'll do my best to answer it. And of course, we always wrap it around the trucking lifestyle. We're going to get to those calls in just a couple minutes. I do want to talk today about some of the things we've been going through with the Signature truck and give you an update on what I've got most recently. But before I do that, I want to talk in general about the things that I do here, and especially when I do projects. And I know that when I take on projects, I'm taking on a risk. The project could fail. And when one of our projects fails, it's very visible. We are in front of everybody virtually all the time. And you know, we don't hide anything here. No matter what's going on with a project, we talk about it. So the more complicated a project gets, the more possibility there is for something to go wrong. But one of the other things we have to be aware of, and this is just human nature. When you recommend things the way I do, whether it's a product, a service, a company, a financial strategy, software, people ask me lots of questions. They're looking for advice. I always run the risk that right after they try something, something could go wrong. And many times it could have nothing whatsoever to do with what I recommended, but human nature is always to think that it did. And this goes for shops too. Anybody that runs a repair shop or any service business like that, if you take your truck in and the shop works on the engine, and then 2 days later, something goes wrong with your engine, the natural tendency is to believe that, well, it was just in the shop and they messed with the engine. And sometimes it might be. Many times, though, they were totally unrelated. For example, I just had an engine failure. And had I been in the shop a couple days before and had any kind of engine work done, oil change service, whatever, I'd be wondering, did they do something? And I'll give you another example that I never knew, whether or not the shop did something or not. I really think in this case they might have, but I had an engine with about 250,000 miles on it. And this was when I was first testing bypass oil filters. And I took it into a shop to get a bypass oil filter installed. When the engine went in the shop, its oil consumption was very normal for an engine of that time. It would use a gallon somewhere between 12 and 15,000 miles, very consistently. I took it in the shop. They put the bypass oil filter on and changed the oil while it was in there. The day the truck came out of the shop, it started using a gallon of oil every 1,500 miles. Now, my only thought was, did they drain the oil out of this? Somebody come by and start it up to try to move it? I never knew. The good thing at the time was it was a Detroit engine. It was under the factory warranty. They didn't question anything. They just did the in-frame on it. I only lost a couple days and really didn't cost me much. But I always wondered. It certainly could have been something else. And many times it is, but it's human nature. And again, I just lost an engine, and you always wonder, what did I do? What did somebody else do? We've got a lot of that going on with the signature truck. A lot of things we do know what happened. Some things, now that I've gotten more and more facts in and more opinions in from different people, I realize there are some things we're just never going to know. But one of the things that we do know, and I do want to address on this show, is that early on in the life of the truck, we had an overheating issue. And when we first talked about it on the air, and we had lots of people on the call with us, and there was some speculation that it could have been the Evans coolant. So we're going to talk about that, because that is something we absolutely know now that it wasn't. And to help me out with that, I'm going to bring on Tom Light. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, great to have you here. Why don't you let everybody know what it is that you do over at Evans?
Well, I run this company called Evans Cooling Systems, Inc., and our business is primarily non-aqueous engine coolant. That's coolant that is not formulated with water. It's not a concentrate that you add water to. It's not a premix that has water in it. Our coolant has less than 1% water, and the reason for that is that we try to avoid the formation of vapor in the cooling system, because vapor will displace liquid coolant and reduce the heat transfer from hot metal to the liquid coolant. So our idea is you need a fluid with a high boiling point, certainly, but also even more important is that you are able to condense vapor at a high temperature. I'm not sure what kind of details you want to go into.
That's outstanding. You know, one of the I want to kind of let people know how I came across Evans. And before I do that, though, I think I've said this a couple of times. I want to make sure I'm correct. Is it the only coolant on the market without water in the formulation?
As far as we know, it is. We market a lot of our coolant in China, and in China, there are always imitators or people trying to jump on a bandwagon. So these little homegrown brands come and go, but we don't really see that happening in the United States.
Got it. Okay. So several years ago, I'm thinking it might have been back as long as 2008, 2009, I had a question on the air, and it was about mixing coolants and all the different colors and different nomenclatures and names and brands. And I had to say, when I got the question, that I didn't know the answer. And one of the things about the show is I don't like to have to say that. So I realized it was time that, even though I knew quite a bit about maintenance and engines, I knew almost nothing about coolant. I mean, I knew you put it in, you checked the level, and, you know, if your engine didn't overheat or freeze, you were okay, I thought. And I thought, you know what, that's not good enough. I need to go learn. So I started reading everything I could get. I found somebody who had been in the coolant industry for a long time, and I spent a lot of time talking to them. And I learned a lot about coolant. And I found out that when it comes to coolant, I wasn't alone in being so ignorant. In fact, I read a big survey. Over half of the repair shops in the country, now we're talking about heavy truck repair shops, over 50% of them, when they were surveyed, could not tell what coolant should go in what engine. They knew as little about coolant as I did when I started, but these are the people we trust to know that kind of stuff, and I was shocked. So I learned as much as I could, and in the process of that learning, I came across your product, and I was so intrigued because it was so different. Everything else I was looking at was basically water and glycol, and I believe it's ethylene glycol or the other coolants, correct?
Yes. It might be propylene glycol and, with water, but it's always a combination used with water.
Got it. Okay. So, and I'm coming up on a break, so I'm going to come back and finish this up. I was very intrigued when I found your coolant because it was so different than all these other brands that I was looking at. We're going to talk about that a little bit more right around the corner. Don't go away. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to the phones. And again, I was talking with Tom Light from Evans Coolant. And so, Tom, when I found your product, and you know, I was intrigued, but like I do with most products when I find it, I don't immediately contact the company. I do some research. Many times we'll test the product. And it took me quite a while because it was a very different product. And it was so unusual from what I knew. But after doing the research and realizing that this really was, in my mind, clearly a better way to handle the heating issues of trucks. So, and we contacted you, and you guys have been a great resource in teaching me more about cooling systems and helping me understand. And, of course, we've partnered with you now for many years. Very happy with the product. I've converted all of my own trucks, and I've helped other people convert, and we've had many, many great stories of people now that have had the product in their truck for a long, long time. So we're very happy with it. Now, what happened on the Signature truck, and the reason that I wanted to talk to you, one, to kind of get everybody caught up on the product again, because it has been a couple years since we've had you on the air and talked about it. But two, to clarify a couple things, when the truck first overheated, there was some concern that possibly the shop that was working on it, I believe it was the first time for them that they had put Evans in a factory remanned engine. And I'm not even sure where this came from, but they had some concerns that the anti-corrosive compounds that were used in the remanufacturing process may have had some sort of interaction with the Evans coolant. Now, had they asked me at the time, they didn't, I would have said no, because we've done this before, never had a problem. So what they did was take the Evans out, they put the standard coolant back in, and immediately had the same overheating problems. So that's a pretty clear indication that we've eliminated the fact that the coolant was the issue. Then as we talked more and more, somebody brought up the fact that the Evans coolant and a dimpled radiator, which again, I wasn't made aware that this truck had a dimpled radiator, that there may have been some issues there. And that was when I said, That's the first time I've heard that. We don't deal very often with the dimpled radiators anyway. Let me get a hold of Evans and get a hold of Tom, and we'll get the answer to this. So that's why we've asked you to come on and help us understand some of this.
Well, I can't say we've had a lot of experience with dimpled radiators. However, we know that we like a fairly low flow resistance in the radiator so that we have good flow going through the engine. The turbulence is good for getting for carrying heat away from hot surfaces. It's also a good way to get heat from the liquid to the metal in the radiator. There are variations in radiators that we see out there. We are of the opinion that the best kind of a radiator is one that has a single pass and low flow resistance and good ability to pass air through it. It's not doesn't have so many rows that it's blocking flow there. When you think about heat transfer going on inside of an engine and a cooling system, you have various things going on. You have hot metal in the engine transferring heat to the liquid coolant. The liquid coolant is circulated by the pump. It makes its way to the radiator where the heat in the liquid transfers to the metal of the radiator. And then the next step is that the heat that is in the metal of the radiator must transfer into the ambient air. And actually, that's the toughest heat transfer of all because you're transferring from a metal to a gas. And the heat transfer of air is far less than anything that you would encounter between liquids and metals. Now, having said that, we run into people who will analyze our coolant versus water-based coolant and tell us, and we don't contest this at all, that water is just about the greatest thing for heat transfer that you could imagine because it has a good thermal conductivity and it has a high specific heat and it really works quite well. However, the water in your coolant or your coolant is operated fairly close to its boiling point. In fact, your whole cooling system is designed to try to keep that coolant from boiling. And that's because the water boils at a fairly low temperature, you know, compared to many liquids. And when you have boiling going on, you have the release of water vapor, and that can be that would be happening at the hottest locations in the engine where you have an intersection of hot metal and coolant. And if you do some boiling there, if that vapor cannot condense immediately, you can build a pocket of vapor. And just like air doesn't transfer heat very well, water vapor does not transfer heat very well. And that's how you can build a hot spot locally inside the engine. There is that issue of vapor. Now, beyond that, how about the circulation of coolant through the engine itself? We have people telling us, people that aren't actually working with the coolant, they tell us that because of the characteristics of our coolant compared with a water-based coolant, that our coolant will run at a much higher temperature, you know, way, way higher temperature. Well, that's not the case either. We might run a couple of degrees Celsius warmer. It's almost nothing. It's just a slight increase. And again, the reason for that is that we're not having difficulty moving the heat into our liquid or from the metal or from the liquid to the metal in the radiator. It's what we call the air side limitation. That's the great equalizer here. Now, getting back to talking about flow resistance in the radiator, that's really a big deal. Our coolant is more viscous than a water-based coolant, and in that respect, we like to see as low resistance as possible in the radiator, and that's why we favor the single-pass radiator, because it has the lowest flow resistance. There are other... excuse me?
I want to jump in there real quick, because this is one of those issues that I learned a lot from talking to you, because it's one of those issues that on the surface, something sounds like it makes a lot of sense until you understand the entire issue and then you realize why it doesn't. And what I'm talking about are these attempts at building better radiators that would have a higher cooling capacity, whether they're double pass or dimpled. Or the idea that I've heard over time is that keep the coolant in the radiator longer and it will have more time to transfer the heat, or dimple the tube so there's more surface, or all these things that, again, the first time I heard them, they sound like they make sense. But what you explained to me yesterday was really every attempt at doing that has created more restriction in the radiator. And without that flow, we're actually doing the opposite many times of what they were attempting to do. And what you found is that the good old single pass, get it through the radiator, don't restrict the flow, get it through there, it works better than anything.
Well, yes, think of it this way, Kevin. If you slow the passage of the fluid through your radiator, you will come out of the bottom of the radiator with a much greater delta T than if you speed it through its path in a single pass.
Well, hold that thought, and when we come back, I want you to explain what a delta T is so that we get that. Stick around. We'll be right back. If you've got any questions about cooling systems, this would be a great time to ask them. We'll try to get to some questions if we have time here after this break. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to the phones, and I'm going to bring Tom back on. Tom, if you could take just a couple seconds and explain to us what you meant by the delta T.
All right. the delta T is the temperature difference that you would get across a radiator from the fluid going into it versus the fluid coming out of it, and it's easy to think that if you have a better delta T, a higher delta T, in other words, the temperature drops more going through the radiator, that's a really good thing. Well, usually that means that you're slowing down the path. You have extra loops or something. You have a high flow resistance. Yes, your coolant will spend more time in the radiator. It will drop in temperature more. But think of it this way. You're also taking that coolant back up through the engine. It's also moving slower through the engine so that you have a greater temperature increase going through the engine. So you really haven't gained anything. The best thing is to have a fairly small delta T across the radiator and then have a small delta T going through the engine the other direction. And again, that delta T is nothing but nothing more than just a fancy way to say one temperature less than the other. The temperature out minus the temperature in would be the delta T of the engine, and the delta T of the radiator would be the temperature of the fluid going into the radiator less the temperature coming out. So that's all it is. It's nothing really fancy.
Well, and that was a great explanation, and again, it's one of those things that until it's really explained, it does sound like it would be better to have that big temperature differential. It's going in really hot, it's coming out cooler, the radiator must be doing its job, but in order to do it, if it has to slow down that flow, then now I understand, after you explained it, we're slowing down the flow in the whole system, which means that hot coolant is now spending more time in the engine. And now it makes sense. Just keep it moving.
Yes, yes, that's right. Another way you can think about it is if your radiator is always closer to the higher temperature, you have a better delta. Again, we're going to use the word delta T. The delta T, that's the temperature between the metal on the radiator and the temperature of the air that is cooling it. The more separation you have, the greater the difference in those temperatures, the easier it is to move the heat out of the radiator.
Got it. That makes sense. Now, one of the things that you and I talked about is that, and I think you started to touch on this, was the composition of the ovens makes it slightly more viscous. And you are looking for better flow, but what you've explained is it doesn't really matter what the coolant is. The better the flow in the radiator, the better off we're going to be. We don't want these radiators that are slowing down the flow in an attempt to hold the coolant in longer to try to cool it more. Now that makes total sense. What do you think about taking a couple questions? We've got some questions coming in.
Sure, be happy to.
Let's do that. Let's go to Ohio. Ken, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Okay. Good. What's on your mind today?
My question was if you can have a higher operating temperature of your engine, well, at what percentage do you think that'll increase fuel mileage for a better thermal efficiency?
I'll jump in there real quick, and then, Tom, I'll let you follow up if you want. I did a lot of research on this, and according to Detroit, now this was their testing with their engines, and I'm sure if Cat were to do testing or Cummins, and I couldn't find any that they published, the numbers might be slightly different, but Detroit said that if we use a baseline of 170 degrees operate, no, it might have been 160 as a baseline, every 10 degrees hotter you ran it, they claimed a 1% improvement in fuel economy. I don't remember what the upper limits were because at some point we have to be concerned about, you know, just getting things too hot. Tom, do you have any other numbers?
We see fuel economy increases running warmer. I'm not sure we understand all of the reasons for that. For one thing, the oil plowing through a Between the piston and the wall, you have a film of oil. If that oil is thick, you introduce a resistance for the movement of the piston. Your lubricity actually improves if that oil is less viscous. So there's an opportunity there for fuel economy increases. We have seen engines that improve fuel economy by running a little bit warmer and having the fan operating less of the time. If you're able to do that, you can pick up some fuel economy. And of course, in a modern engine with so much going on with EGR cooling and maybe turbo workings and so on, a little bit higher temperature gives you a fuel economy advantage that you wouldn't get at the lower temperatures.
Yeah, both of those that you mentioned, and one of those is something we talk about here quite often. It's one of the reasons why we see increases in fuel economy with a synthetic oil, because of less parasitic drag from the oil itself. And now we're seeing engine manufacturers that are moving to 30-weight oils instead of 40-weight. And their whole point is they're trying to meet the new government fuel mileage standards, and they're squeezing out everything they can in a 30-weight oil. Less viscous, allows the engine to move freer, so we get some gains there. When you raise the temperature of the oil, like you said, Tom, it becomes less viscous. So between that and having being able to run an engine at a higher temperature without the fan coming on as often is actually a pretty big advantage, because that fan has a tremendous amount of pull off the engine. Does that make sense, Ken?
Yes, sir. I have a overachieving radiator. You know, I have a hard time getting it over 175 when I'm cruising flatland. What's the highest operating temperature Evans recommends for the engine to be at?
Well, we know that we can take engines to exotic temperatures. But we really are more in favor of evolutionary changes. We think that a fan turning on at say 230 is not very radical, and can give you advantages. That doesn't mean that there aren't people out there playing around at much higher temperatures, what we have is a fairly, I won't call it a radical product, but it's certainly different, and we want to work in the marketplace in an evolutionary improvement area rather than trying to see how radical we can get with it.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time.
Okay. You're welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. Tom, if I could, if we could do one more question, let's go to Georgia. Mike, welcome to the program.
How you doing, guys? I just wondered, I have a 2000 Freightliner. Can that be used in an old truck like that, or do I have to... What's the situation with that?
Tom, you know what? He wants to know if the Evans coolant is good in an older engine, a 2000. I certainly have some opinions about that. The music's playing, though, so I'm going to have to get to a break. When I come back, Tom, I'll let you answer that, and then I'll jump in with my opinion as well. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Thank you. All right, real quick, everyone, just to give you a heads up, at the end of this segment, I will say all those things I say at the end of a show. I'm done. I'm out of here. Good night. Don't hang up because we're going to come back and record a second hour after this segment. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. We're going to get right back to the calls. Before the break, I was talking with Tom Light from Evans and Mike in Georgia. And Mike was wondering if we could use the Evans coolant in an older engine. So I'm going to let Tom answer that question first. Tom, go ahead, and then I'll jump in with my experience.
Well, Mike, when you're working with an older engine, which I assume has many, many hours and many, many miles under its belt, you would certainly want to know that the engine was operating the way it was supposed to. It might need a rebuild. It might have some issues that have cropped up, and we might be a little bit fearful that putting our coolant in there might work okay, but if some issue cropped up based on what else might be going on with the engine, we would be a little bit hesitant. But certainly there are exceptions. There are many engines that are maintained in excellent condition, and an older engine of that type could profit by the use of the Evans coolant. We don't generally reach out to the market where you've got machinery that has really been around, because we want people to have a successful outcome. And we don't want some other issue standing in the way of that. But that's about it. Other than that, the Evans coolant would certainly work in an older engine that was in good shape.
Yeah,
right,
Tom, you know, that's a great approach, I believe, from the company standpoint. You want to make sure that, you know, the customer has a good experience, and we want to make sure there isn't some other circumstance that would, you know, stop that from happening. One of the things that I like to do, because I am out here making recommendations and helping people, I kind of like to push some of the things to the extremes to see, knowing that I may cause a failure, not just of your product, of many of the products I test. And, you know, when we first met and I was testing the products and I wanted to make sure, you know, I had a personal experience with it, we converted several of my trucks, all of them high mileage. Several of them that were high mileage had not had an in-frame, so they were, you know, high mileage with wear. Now, obviously, they were well-maintained trucks and we made sure there weren't any problems. But we also, you know, went the extra step, bumped up our temperatures, turned our fans, you know, not to come on till higher temperatures. We did see the fuel mileage increases that we documented, and we never had a problem. I was personally involved in a couple of the early conversions, and a couple of those owner-operators years later call back and say, you know, they had high mileage trucks then. They're even higher mileage trucks now, and they're doing great. So the caution of make sure the engine is in good working condition. That's something we try to stress around here all the time, because many of the products I talk about and recommend are outside of the norm. And we want to make sure that we're not exacerbating a problem that already exists. So, like I say, I think that's a great approach from the company. And Tom, I've got to move on. I really appreciate you coming on today. I know I certainly understand this issue much better now.
Well, it's my pleasure to have been able to spend a little time on your show. I think the work you're doing is very admirable, very positive, and I think it's good work.
Thank you. And we will be in touch. I always learn something when I get a chance to talk to you. So, again, thanks, and we appreciate the partnership and all the resources. Let's roll along to some phone calls here. Let's go to Oklahoma. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Fair tax yesterday. I've kind of walked into a situation here, and I kind of need to get a kind of a pulse of if I'm going about doing it right or doing it wrong. And I have a feeling you're going to yell at me, but it's worth a try.
Okay.
I found my dream truck. It's a kind of a rare truck, and I was just, you know, getting to where I was saving money and everything, and I got a hold to the guy, and I was just asking him about the configuration of the truck itself. He threw out some good specs and everything like that, and I told him, I was just asking about the truck, and he called me. I gave him my number, and he called me, and he said that he had a driver that quit, that he had a sale that fell through, and that he had a driver that quit at the same time. I told him I can't afford the truck cash right now. So you can see where this is going. He offered to let me run the truck for a couple of months and then pay it off. Am I walking myself into headache and heartache here, or is there a way that I can set this up that both of us can win at this? Or
yeah, there is, and there's a couple ways. And this is a little different than me beating people up over the whole lease purchase thing. And let me just explain some of the quick differences. Many of the carriers with lease purchase programs, in fact, in my mind, the majority of the carriers with lease purchase programs have set those programs up as profit centers. You know, the trucking business can be tough. There's not a lot of margin. And they found a way to add money to the bottom line by leasing trucks to people who really shouldn't be leasing trucks. And the contracts are all written in their favor. The programs are set up so that they are virtually guaranteed a profit, and the owner-operator is the one who has to really, really struggle and hope everything goes right in order for them to make a profit. So that's the difference. I mean, that isn't what we're talking about here. We're talking about somebody who has a truck. They have an incentive to get rid of that truck, and they're looking at a way to get you into it. You know, they've got a buyer. They feel good about you. They're looking at a way to help you. So right off the bat, this is different. And it would come down to the structure. I mean, ultimately, here's what I would like to see. I would love to see the fact that on day one, the title gets transferred to your name with the lien.
All right.
That would be... if we can do that, then this guy's just any other bank that loaned us money to buy a truck. On the other hand, he may say, oh, that's a lot of risk. You know, I would prefer that you give me some money and I'll hold the title and we'll call this a rental or a lease period. And when you pay it off, then you'll get the title. I'm not as wild about that because it puts you in a weaker legal position if something goes wrong. But if this is going to happen in a short enough period of time and you don't have a ton of money at risk, I could even be okay with that. Now, what I would recommend, no matter what the other party says, I would highly recommend that this is done with an attorney.
Gotcha. So,
you know, somebody have to, you know, $500 to $1,000. I don't know. I think we could get an attorney that would do it for that. That just draws up the contract so you know what your legal obligation and rights are, and the other party knows what their legal obligations and rights are. Because if we don't do it that way and something goes wrong, then it's just a free-for-all. I mean, nobody knows. Yeah, and that's when things get ugly.
All right. Do you got a second that I can ask you about some specs real quick just to make sure that I am looking at this the right way then?
Yeah, go ahead.
11.1 liter Series 60, 373 rears with a 10 speed.
Okay. Is this a cab over by chance?
Yes, it is. It's a 9700 International, which you know are rare as hen teeth sometimes, so that's why I'm kind of jumping on this as fast as I can. He pulled the ECM, has a lifetime of 6.5 with absolutely no modification for fuel economy. And he's
dual mileage trucks. The music's playing, so I'm going to have to kind of get through this. This is a truck that I would not want to put on any extreme operations. I wouldn't want to pull reefer from Colorado to the West Coast. I'd love a truck like this pulling anywhere where I'm not going to be real heavy and I'm not going to face a lot of pull, unless I was able to really build the engine stronger than what it is. But I love these specs. This could be a very fuel-efficient, very cost-efficient truck. With that said, I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me. I'm all out of time. Be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, we're going to go right into a second hour here and get to a bunch of questions. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started in the business, finding freight, working with brokers. As a matter of fact, if you have any question at all, bring it to the table. I'll do my best to answer it. If I can't answer it, many times somebody listening will help us out. Of course, we always wrap all of the questions and answers around the trucking lifestyle, living and working on the road. And I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to get right to phone calls. Let's get started in Pennsylvania. Nick, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. I've got a question about the EPA SmartWay verification. I'm looking at purchasing new tires, and I'm unable to locate a rolling resistance for the specific brand and model that I'm looking at. But the manufacturer is claiming EPA SmartWay verification on this model of tire. Can you explain to us what that process is and what it means, if anything?
Yeah, I'll try to do my best. I haven't worked really hard to verify this. I'm about 90% sure I'm correct, but it's a government program. And I swear, every time I try to figure out anything the government is doing, I get a headache. And to me, it's just another typical government program, overblown, overinflated, overcomplicated, and doesn't produce any real results. The idea, I thought, was to create a way to know that a tire is very fuel efficient. I mean, that would be my criteria. If I were putting out a program, and what we're trying to do is lower greenhouse gases and save fuel. Well, that's a great goal, but instead of giving us some sort of a clear rating, the way that I believe Michelin has done. You know, when you hear me give out rolling resistance numbers, those numbers were created by Michelin. The whole scale was created by Michelin. I mean, they developed the number. They said, okay, here is our most popular tire. We're going to give it a number 100, and now we can rate every tire against that. That makes sense. Now I have a scale I can look at and know this tire is clearly more fuel efficient than that tire. The number tells me everything I need to know. Does that make sense so far?
Absolutely. And that's my problem is I can't find a number on this tire.
Right. Right. And that's because the only company, I shouldn't say the only company anymore. Yokohama has finally gotten into the game, but they're quite a ways behind on testing tires. The only company I'm aware of that does the testing and publishes the numbers is Michelin. There's a lot of tires on the market. There's new tires being brought out all the time. And the testing is time-consuming and expensive. So they don't have every tire on the market tested, and I don't think they ever will, but they do a pretty good job of trying to keep up. Now, we go to the EPA SmartWave verification. And the manufacturers love this program because it gives them a way to put something on their tire that makes it sound like it's better. But it's typical marketing, in my opinion. Here's the way I understand the EPA verification. The EPA says, okay, let's take and we'll classify tires by type and size. So for a closed shoulder lug style drive tire in the tall 24.5 category, what is the best selling tire? And they pull the best selling tire out of that group and they say, okay, this tire might have a rolling resistance of 152. All you have to do in that category to get EPA SmartWay verified is beat that tire by 10%. That is ridiculous.
I would try. I have a 105 rolling resistance set of tires now and a 150. Oh, I'd freak out.
Exactly. Now, let's just say it's a 150 to make the math easy. The tire to get certified only has to be a 135. That's crazy. Plus, not only is it crazy, it doesn't tell us anything. Could be that the best tire in that category is a 110. So now the tire to get certified would have to be a 99. Now that would be okay, but I don't know that because they haven't given us any kind of a scale we can compare things to. All they've done is said, we have this weird formula we came up with, and once you meet the formula, you can say you're EPA SmartWay verified. It's so crazy, I thought my head was going to explode. I thought, I'm just going to ignore this program. It's ridiculous.
Basically, if I can't, you know, as you say, do the hard work, if we can't, you know, put our finger on the number, walk away from it, doesn't matter how good the deal is.
That's my take on this. There are too many good tires on the market that we do know the number. There is no way I would ever take a chance on a tire where I didn't know the number.
Okay. That answers everything I needed. Thank you very much, Kevin. Fair tax all the way.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call. Good question. Let's go to Alabama. Dane, welcome to the program.
James. Oh, yeah. Hey, Kevin, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I just wanted to do an update on some goals I discussed with you about last month. As far as weight is concerned, my goal to reach be down 40 pounds by July, I've lost 12 pounds so far. I'm down to, 236. The job I wanted to apply for, I got my DAC report. That thing's cleaner than I thought it would be. I actually had some issues that I thought were going to be in there. They're not there at all. So I applied today for that job. And my savings for debt, a credit card debt, for $5,000, I've saved up a little bit over $800 on that so far. So
wow.
My update on those goals.
The future's so bright, you've got to wear shades.
Yeah, exactly. But when you're talking about Fairtex now, I have a tax question for you.
Okay, hey, before you get to your tax question, I've got a question for you. On the weight loss goal, 12 pounds is outstanding. I think that that's a great pace to keep. How are you feeling? Are you feeling good?
Yeah, my energy level is fairly well. I exercise 3 times a day, and the most difficult one is at night. All I want to do is sleep, instead of exercise for that 10 minutes, So I've been trying to actually take care of the third one during the middle of the day. And, energy levels are okay. I have to talk to Kim about my diet, because sometimes my energy level is just waning badly, and I think it has to do with what I'm eating. So,
and that's kind of why I asked it. Let me jump in there, because I've done this many, many times over the years. I've never had what anybody would consider any kind of real weight problem. I'm one of those guys that can put on 30 to 40 pounds more than I should be, though. And because I lift a lot, sometimes it doesn't look like I'm overweight, but I know when I'm overweight, 30, 35 pounds, and I feel it. And I've yo-yoed back and forth over the last 30 years, and I've tried all kinds of different ways of eating. I don't even like the word diet. I just try different ways to eat, different foods, those kind of things. And I have to say that the most recent, which I thought, it's been around a while, there's some tweaks to it, I thought was insane. I thought these people were just crazy, didn't make any sense to me. But it was only because I didn't understand it enough to know. And I think the problem is most people don't understand it enough to get it right. And real quick, what it is I eliminated all grains completely. That had nothing to do with weight. That was more about the fact that we're just not meant to eat grains. They're toxic. They don't digest well, all kinds of things. But along
with
the grains.
Are you talking about bread? Like bread would be grains?
Let me go through them real quick. Anything that has wheat, rye, barley, rice, corn, spelt, anything that grows as a grass, which all those are. They're just basically big grasses. They're grains. We were never meant to eat them at all. And I eliminated those for a lot of other reasons, but the weight dropped like crazy. And I was never hungry, and that's a first for me. So stick around. I'll go into that just a little more, and then I'll get on to your question. So we'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm going to get back to the phones. I was talking with James in Alabama. So this came about because I was doing some research. Actually, I was helping Kim out doing some research, and I got really, really in-depth into a couple books. One was called Wheat Belly, Total Health. There's actually a book called Wheat Belly, and then there's a new update to it called Wheat Belly, Total Health, which is a different book. And another one called Grain Brain. And after reading those books and following up, I didn't just believe the books. I followed up, did tons of research. They made so much sense. I said, I'm a little extreme. I'm going cold turkey, just dropping all grains. Now, they recommend you do it slower over time. I went cold turkey. It was a little rough, first couple weeks, you know, you don't feel all that great. But there's two problems with grains, two totally separate issues, and I think this is what's part of the confusion. One is that they're toxic to our bodies and our brains. We shouldn't be eating them. We were never meant to eat them. The second one is that they're all very high in carbohydrates, and carbohydrates are just sugars once they're in your body. Because our diet is so high in grain, and we've been told that whole grains are healthy, they're actually worse. Our diet has become 60% carbohydrate. So what we've done is we've trained our bodies to use sugar as energy, and it works. And it's actually a very easy source of energy for your body. If there's sugar available, your body will use it for energy. The problem is whatever you don't use, and when you're eating 60% of it, you're not using it all, whatever you don't use gets stored as fat. Now, the crazy thing is, when everybody went low carbohydrate, like the Atkins, the Miami Beach, many of the others, the idea was that you were supposed to replace the carbohydrates with protein. And that was the mistake, because your body can use protein as energy, but it's a very difficult process. So what happens is you get rid of the carbohydrates or you cut down on them, and all of a sudden, you don't have any energy. You're sluggish, you're tired, you get headaches. It's miserable. I went through it and thought, this is the stupidest thing I've ever done. Right. Well, what I finally learned is that you leave your protein the way it is. Our diet should be about 20% protein, some animal, some, you know, plant matter. But when you get rid of the carbohydrates or cut them down drastically, you need to replace them with fat. And people look at you like, you got to be kidding me. I'm trying to lose weight and you want me to eat fat? Yeah, that's exactly what our bodies were meant to use as energy. And when you take in enough fats, your body have more energy than you know what to do with, and it doesn't store it as fat. And when I got this right, and it's not an easy, it requires some pretty major changes. But when I got it right, my energy levels went through the roof and the weight dropped without me ever being hungry or really trying.
You still there, Kevin?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I had to talk to Kim about my diet. But I mean, I don't eat any beef or anything like that, but I eat like chicken. I eat, for as fat, I eat, my fish has some fat with it. I eat fat with it. And, so I do, I get the proteins and with, chicken and fish and all that.
Yeah.
And also I eat almonds. I do eat almonds.
Almonds? Now, all the nuts are excellent. Avocados are fantastic. Here's the thing. We got totally brainwashed and freaked out about animal fats and saturated fats, and all of the research was just wrong. So we started eating chicken breast, skinless, boneless chicken breast, thinking, okay, we're getting good lean protein. Well, yeah, you need some protein, but what we're missing is the fat. We need the fat. So you're taking a bone in whole chicken or a thigh and, you know, sauteing it in some coconut oil and leaving the skin on and eating the skin and the coconut oil. We need that. And we've just been so brainwashed. Like I said, I didn't just take one book or two books and believe them. I did a bunch more research, but then even more important, I tried it. I was a vegetarian for 4 years. And you know what? It didn't work all that great for me at all in a lot of ways.
I hear that around, yeah.
I went off on a rant. Now you can go ahead with your question.
My next question is this. A friend of mine, she took out, she cashed in some stocks from a company that she was working in. It was like $75,000. Unfortunately, what happened is that Hewlett Packard didn't really enter that in to her tax return the correct way, and she didn't pay $15,000 of the taxes on that. Now, of course, the IRS is coming back to her saying, you owe us $15,000 by X date. Well, Jackson Hewitt, I'm sorry, Jackson Hewitt, says, well, our gold plan guarantee, which they don't put that much gold behind it, we'll pay $5,000 of that, right, if we find that it was our fault that caused it, which it was, and we'll pay the taxes and fees up until this point. Well, she still owes $10,000 plus all the taxes and fees that it's going to take for her to pay all that back. Now, my question to you is, what is the best way for her to pay that back or get it reduced?
Yeah, here's the problem. This is why I hate our tax system. It's why I've pushed for so many years to get a fair tax, because our tax system is not fair at all. And I don't mean just in all the crazy, 70,000 pages of code. I mean in the way that it's enforced. Our tax code is so complicated that the average person ends up paying somebody else to do their tax return for them. That's why we have firms like H&R Block and Jackson Hewitt and Liberty and a million little accounting offices, because the average person can't do this. But the IRS says it doesn't matter if you pay somebody else to do this. You are signing the document saying it is true and correct. Well, yeah. How can you know it's true and correct? Knew that it was true and correct, you wouldn't have to pay somebody, you would just do it yourself. No sense to me at all.
Yeah.
But that's the
yeah.
rule. Now, and I just think that's totally wrong. But the IRS, for the most part, says, look, you signed the document. You are responsible. So the IRS is out of it. You can't do much with them at all. Now, the tax itself, let's set aside any interest and penalties. The tax itself, I don't think the tax preparer should ever have to pay any of that. And here's my reasoning behind that. Had they done it correctly, owed that money. So nothing changed because they screwed that up as far as how much tax is owed. I think once the mistake is found, then you should just have to pay that tax. You would have had to pay it if they would have done it right. Now the interest
instead of paying
and penalties,
it then, you would have to pay it now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the interest and penalty are another matter. In my opinion, if it's clearly a mistake by the tax preparer, they should have to pay all of the interest and penalties. The only way you can get them to do that, though, you can always ask them, and it sounds like that's obviously people would ask, and they're saying, here's our policy. The only other choice you have is to take them to court.
Right. But as far as dealing with the IRS, she has to pay this full $10,000? There's no way of reducing that?
I am going to tell you that there's no way to reduce it. And the reason I'm going to tell you that, there's a clear reason, and that isn't 100% true. But my fear is there are so many companies out there that make all these wild claims, and you see all the commercials on TV and you hear them on the radio about we will negotiate with the IRS and you will only pay pennies on the dollar. That's my fear, that she's going to get hooked up with somebody like that. And I don't
right.
want her to do that, because those companies are scams. Those programs are almost never accepted. It is such a tiny, tiny percentage. And virtually the only time the IRS accepts those offers in compromise, that's the term for it, is when they believe that you are so destitute they will never collect this money from you, that you have nothing to offer. You have no assets. You don't have a job. You don't have any income. You don't have any chance of getting a job. And you've got some cash. They might accept the offer. But it's so rare, and these companies make it sound like it happens every day. It doesn't. Now, what she can do is go to a CPA or an EA, an enrolled agent, or a tax attorney. And, of course, you're going to have to pay these people. And she might be able to get a second opinion, and they might be able to negotiate the penalties down some. The interest they're not going to negotiate down, because she owed the money and she didn't pay it on time, so now she owes the interest, they might negotiate the penalties. But I don't even want to give her much hope on that. This is the problem with our overcomplicated tax system. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. We're off to New Mexico. Carl, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. Well, I have a headache now. Some aspirin.
Yeah.
Oh, I have an oil sample.
All right. Let's take a look and see what we've got. Is this a zero? On the thing. Oh, now I've got it in front of me. Hold on. I was stalling there to see if I could find it. Now I found it. So, yeah. So it is a zero. We've got a. Oh, it doesn't tell me what kind of engine. What engine and what year?
It's an 07 Detroit, Series 60.
Okay. How many miles on the engine?
It's 830,000,
okay.
Something like that.
Yeah. All I need is a rough idea. And it says here about 20,000 miles on the oil when you took the sample, right?
Right. That was your recommendation the last time I talked to you about it.
Got it.
I had changed it early before.
Yeah. Has anything ever been fixed on this engine? Like, have we made the emissions better in any way?
After that oil change and sample, I had the, I took it in the shop and they found the cowl coats all screwed up and they fixed that problem. So the next oil sample will hopefully look better than that one.
That's not possible. That's kind of why I was asking if this, if this had ever had the emissions eliminated or anything like that. This oil sample is so clean, I can't believe it. Go to 20,000. You can easily go to 25,000. This oil is just super clean. I mean, this engine is really performing well, and I mean it's a zero.
Well,
nothing
it's
is
definitely high. Doing better since I come out of the shop at the Calcoats set the way they were supposed to be. The last time I talked to you, I said, you know, I was having a loss of power, had a little bit more fuel dilution, and had some other issues going on with it, and that's corrected. The fuel mileage is a little bit better. It's pulling better. You know, I'm getting ready to move forward with other things like getting some new tires and then getting new fuel lines and everything that's involved in the fuel lines, like the pass, and I'll probably put a new fuel pump on it.
Good. As far as oil samples go, this engine is a clear exception. Like, I see this so rarely, and what I mean by that is this is an emission engine, so emission engines always burn dirtier. This type of an oil sample at 20,000 miles, about the only time I would expect an oil sample like this is on a 6NZ Cat that has been tuned and maintained by a shop like Pittsburgh Power. You know, we have a fleet air filter, we have a high flow manifold, a muffler, the ECM's been tweaked and tuned just about perfect, and clean engine anyway, the 6NZ. Then I might expect an oil sample like this. It's pretty rare. On an emission engine, it's almost unheard of. I almost never see oil samples this clean.
Wow, that makes me feel good.
So you have got a winner. I would just smile about this one because it is doing fantastic. Let's go to Arizona. Taylor, welcome to the program.
Hi. I had a question about the Bridgestone M710s. If you knew about basically if they wear well. I mean, I looked at them comparing them to like the Michelin X1s and X1 line Energy Ds, and they're only about a tenth of a mile, rough estimate, worse for rolling resistance. But they're
right.
Cheaper. I mean, they are duals, but I'm kind of skeptical really on how well they wear, honestly. And if you compare them to the X lines, you know, the dual Energy Ds, they're actually better than those, apparently. But I don't really know about the wearing, how well they wear.
You won't get quite as many miles out of them in the long run, but the fuel savings over the dual, if we're comparing head-to-head to the dual, the fuel savings will always trump the additional miles you get out of the tire. So I don't look too hard at how many miles I can get out of a tire. Now, it's a really nice bonus if I can get a very low rolling resistance tire and it lasts a very long time. That's a huge bonus. But my first priority is the fuel savings, because it doesn't take much in the way of fuel savings to add up really quick. Say getting, you know, an extra 50,000 miles on a tire, I mean, we can hardly measure that in the profit and loss statement. So the 710 probably won't last as long as the X line, but I've never run the tire, so I don't have personal experience, but I get a lot of feedback from people, and people really like that tire. I mean, you shouldn't encounter any kind of weird wear issues. It's not because of the tire. It's going to be because of alignment.
Yeah. As far as that, what kind of mileage are people getting on the X1s, like the wide single ones, like as far as lifetime?
Yeah, here's the crazy thing about tire wear. It is so dependent on the truck, the operation, the driver, the part of the country you run in. Just to give you kind of a range, when I ran the X1s, the wide singles, on single axle tractors pulling doubles in Florida and Georgia, which was a big part of my operation, I got about 150,000 miles out of those tires on the drive position. That was it. I know people that get 400,000 miles out of them.
Hmm.
So that's the range. I mean, it's just it's so dependent on so many things.
What is the deal with, like, when you get rims, like the offset, like the half-inch offset? What if I was going to go to those, what should I look for rim-wise?
Well, we want a zero offset rim. That eliminates all of the problems. Now, the 2-inch offset is the most popular rim. It's all over the place. So if you look around for used rims, which is what I recommend doing because you can save a ton of money, if you find 2-inch at a good price, I would buy them, because all you have to do is flip them around and they virtually become a zero offset. You just turn them the other way.
Okay, so zero offset. Yep. Yeah, that pretty much answered my questions, though.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's see, I think I can squeeze in another one here before we get to the break. Let's go to Oregon. Irving, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yep, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yep, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was calling about, I have a
99 Peterbilt, C15 cat, 355 rear ends, and a 15 speed on it. And it's a four axle with a four axle trailer. And I pull the hills up here in Oregon, the Cabbage and 3 Mile and Lad Canyon. And I'm ready to go through my transmission. I was just wondering, I just keep stay with a 15 speed or change it to a 13 speed?
How heavy do you pull? What's your average weight and what's your height?
We call up my average weight about 104,000. It's we haul potatoes, you know, sugar beets, open top.
Yeah. Here's the thing. As far as the hills go, almost any transmission, let's throw a 10-speed out of the mix, because at those weights, I would never recommend a 10-speed. A 15 or an 18, they're all going to pull the same up the hills. The difference is the 15's got a much lower starting gear. So I would stick with the 15. You already own it. I would just go through it and freshen it up.
Okay. Yeah, because I got a pretty fresh engine and brand new rear ends, and I just got to go through the transmission, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I would keep what you've got and either freshen it up or remanufacture it, depending on what it needs once they look at it. But I wouldn't move away from that 15. You already own it, and really, for those kind of weights, it's a great transmission. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Russell. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to the web. Oh, you know what? Yeah, I'll give you the website, but we are just about out of time. The website is letstruck.com, and we're down to the final segment. So I've got a couple things, and then we'll get to some calls. Real quick, earlier I was talking about the way that I'm eating. I don't like to call it a diet because it really doesn't fit any of the traditional diets. I take bits and pieces from everything I research. I mean, if I were to call it a diet and somebody wanted to put a name on it, I'd have to name it because it doesn't follow specifically any of the named or traditional diets. It's just little bits and pieces I've learned over the years, and now some pretty big things that I've learned. But if you want to understand why I gave up grains completely, and I mean completely, I read labels, and if I find wheat, corn, soy, well, not soy, but soy is another reason, MSG, there's 100 different names that grains can show up in processed foods. If I find them on the label, I won't eat the food. I'm that serious about it. And that is not an easy change. But I tell you, it is the single most effective and important change I have ever made in my health. And the results, sometimes the results have been so good, they're kind of scary. It's been several months for me now, and I keep waiting. You know, what's the other side? Is this going to last? And I have to say, so far, the results are pretty amazing, but I couldn't possibly explain all of the reasons, but I can recommend two great books. They're not necessarily easy listens. There's a lot of technical stuff in there, but I think they're worth listening to. One is called Wheat Belly Total Health. Now, there is a book called Wheat Belly, same author. This is a newer version with a lot more information. The other one is called Grain Brain. Let's see. I'm going to get to some calls. Let's go to Indiana. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Today is tax day. As far as I'm concerned, this is a bad day for all of humanity here, especially when I got to pay out $51,000 in state, federal, and Social Security tax. So I got to come up with a plan. Yeah, and I sent the checks off for what I did, but, man, I got to come up with a plan for this year. I'm not incorporated, so, and I'm staring at my tax return here, so what do you need to know, and what do I need to plan for?
Well, I don't even need to know anything from your tax return. That number tells me enough. I know how you end up owing that kind of tax, and I know a couple things that we can do to fix it. Now, let's look at the positive side of today first, just to keep us in the right frame of mind. It's my anniversary with Lisa. That makes it a wonderful day. We did it on purpose, because I couldn't think of a worse day on the calendar than April 15th, and I said, we have to find a way to make it a better day. Let's get married on that day. So it's our anniversary. Happy anniversary to us. And here's another thing we can be very, very positive about. In order to owe that much tax, you must have had a killer year.
Yeah. I'm a fortunate guy. Everything always goes well. I like your show. I take some advice here. But I got 1099 for $332,000 plus another $15,000 for my wife's income. It put me at 120-something thousand for taxable income. I'm an Oregon resident. There's another 9%, which makes me wonder why in the heck you went up there, you know, when you're going to have to pay the state tax. When in Washington, where I work, there's no state tax there at all. So now I got friends that say they're all incorporated and stuff, and maybe I should go that way. But my tax accountant tells me that's not the way to go. I called my retired previous tax accountant. They say that's not the way to go. So what's up with that?
I don't know. I would have to ask them what the hell they're thinking. Here's the thing. Just about everybody I know, once you're in business, now, most people would always recommend when you're getting into business, start off as a sole proprietor. It's easy. It's inexpensive. No complication. Just get started that way. But everybody I know in business and every accountant I know says when you get to the point where you're getting killed in Social Security like that, incorporated. Because it is a clear way to reduce the Social Security and Medicare tax. And I can't understand why you wouldn't do it. So I have no idea what they're thinking. Let me give you a quick rundown of how this works.
As a sole proprietor,
every penny of profit, so you understand profit, we take the 329, whatever it was, we subtract all of your expenses, everything we can come up with, and we end up with this bottom line that they say is your money. And that number, all the way up to $117,000, that's the Social Security cutoff, you will pay Social Security and Medicare tax on every penny up to $117,000. The Social Security will stop there. The Medicare tax never stops. You could have $1 million of net income, and you would have to pay Medicare tax on every penny of it. It never stops. So we don't want to do that, and there's a way around it. The way around E of your corporation, which is required by the IRS that you are an employee of the corporation, and you have to pay yourself a wage. The wage has to be reasonable. Now, that's a pretty ambiguous word. Doesn't define it very well. But we can define it in a couple ways. We can say, okay, look, the IRS says you have to pay yourself for the work you do for the corporation. Well, primarily, the work you do is drive the truck, right?
Yeah.
So we just look at what a truck driver makes for the amount of miles you put on last year. How many miles did you run?
127,000.
Okay. Yeah, so 127, you know, if we were to pay you 40 cents a mile or, you know, an average wage, you'd be $45,000, $50,000 to drive the truck. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah.
Now, what happens is, on that wage that you are paying yourself, that reasonable wage, you will pay all of the taxes, the Social Security tax, the Medicare tax, the income tax, all of that stuff. But once we pay you a wage, and let's say it's $50,000, and what was your net? You said 120-something?
Yeah, the 124. Taxable income line 43 was 124.
Your wife made 15, I think you said?
Yeah.
So, like 109 was your profit from the business. So,
yeah.
Let's say we pay you 50 as a wage. That leaves $59,000 still in the corporation as profit. Now, on profit, you have to pay tax on it, but you pay tax on it as what's either called a dividend or a draw. People use different words, but all you pay on that money is income tax. You don't pay any Social Security or Medicare. So take that $59,000, and what we save is 15.65%. So you save 0.156, about $9,000 in tax.
That's
Why
good.
Wouldn't you do?
Yeah.
Now, there are some additional costs to running a corporation, but they're nowhere near $9,000 a year. Now, you're going to pay your accountant a little more. You're going to pay the tax preparer a little more. You're going to pay somebody to do the payroll. You're going to have some filing fees. I mean, we could say you might run up a $3,000 or a $3,500 a year bill for all those things, but that still puts, you know, a net $6,000 back in your pocket instead of the government's.
Yep. Well, I need to find somebody there in my area that can help me out with this. My tax accountant just told me, you know, he's going to look into this. But, you know, I've been bringing this up for the last 3 years because we've kind of been in the same. The
right.
1099 has been pretty close within $10,000 for the last 3 years. Other than my equipment's paid off, there's no depreciation. The only thing I got is my home mortgage deduction there. And President Obama wants to get rid of that. So,
And none of that stuff means a hill of beans when it comes right down to it. The thing is, when you're in business, it's the Social Security tax that kills you. You know, the little bit of deduction we get on the personal side, mortgage interest and charitable contributions and kids, it helps. But it just doesn't touch any of the Social Security tax. I don't care if you have 47 kids to write off. You still pay all the Social Security tax. The only way around it is to incorporate. That's why so many small businesses do it.
Yeah, the advice I got was that a single person, the IRS doesn't like you going that way. So
what the IRS watches for is abuse by not taking enough of a salary. So
yeah.
Let's say, for example, that, you know, I'm able to generate $250,000 in profit in my corporation, and I'm the only employee, and I try to take a salary of $50. You know, that's probably not going to cut it.
Yeah.
But that's what they're looking for. That's why I clearly said, you know, let's do a reasonable salary. And, you know, paying you $50,000 is reasonable for the job you do for the corporation. And then there's still a huge savings there. So
yeah.
I would absolutely recommend you get a second opinion. Don't take my word for it. Find an accountant who can explain it to you because there is a lot of savings to be had here. I'm all out of time. Thanks for joining me. I've got to get out of here. Be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey.
Good night, everyone. Kevin Roth.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.